It's for me a great honor to be here. It's my first time to this community. Happy to share some of this work. Here's a shameless plug. This book is out in the hallway. You can find it. It's a thing now, and I'm happy to see that. And even though the title is configured of three things, Mormons, musicals, and America, and the book is about that, the big takeaway, I hope, for the book and as well as today's talk is that this is a story about voice. So in musicals, as in real life, singing carries a certain transformative power, even in the service of death. Choirs of angels may be expected in those final moments, a sonic hand grasping a hold of the faithful and pulling them toward their final reward. On the other hand, the sirens ushered unwilling mortals to their death through beautiful singing. And in some versions of the story, the mournful song of Orpheus stops even Sisyphus in his eternal pedaling of the boulder up and down that mountain. But the voice has also occasioned mistrust. Mladen Dolar felt that singing signaled a kind of semantic death, a death of meaning. And what I have up here is a quote from him. "Singing represents a different stage," he writes. "It brings the voice energetically to the forefront, on purpose, at the expense of meaning. Indeed, singing is bad communication. If bad communication is the result of the intoned voice, then it seems the musical stage would be the last place a group could find meaning." And yet, this is the story of how Mormons found great meaning and renewed purpose through exactly such a place. From the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century, Mormons regularly found themselves lampooned on stages of New York, Boston, London, and elsewhere. Invariably, the ridicule drew from a lingering perception throughout the 19th century that, in practicing polygamy, Mormons were actually ethnic minorities. As the Mormon Church attempted to create a more acceptable image for itself and its members in the early 20th century, however, it turned to musical theater as the venue for achieving broader acceptance in American life. In today's paper, I look at how the Mormon voice became magnified whenever Mormons adopted the conventions of American musical theater, the platform from which voice is perhaps the most consequential. I trace the legacy of musicals in and about Mormon life from the 19th century through the commission of the musical Promised Valley in the 1940s. Promised Valley helped Mormons cash in on a particular kind of American identity, but it also illustrates how vocal discipline became the means by which Mormons vied for broader acceptance from the country that they once fled. For much of the 19th century, Mormons were America's favorite caricatures. Mormons and their beliefs were decried in print by figures like Mark Twain and legislated against by Congress. The musical stage was especially cruel to Mormons, however, frequently and without exception portraying Mormon men as sex-crazed polygamists and their women as ignorant chattel. Not only were unpopular practices like polygamy low-hanging fruit for collective ridicule, but more and more audiences seemed to recognize that Mormons and the stage just belonged together. As far back as 1917, one New York Times reviewer of a polygamy-themed operetta puzzled over this, eventually concluding, "Mormonism is just about the only religion that can be exploited in musical comedy." Such a sentiment points to a real ideological connection that Mormons and musicals share. Founded in upstate New York in 1830 by young frontier prophet Joseph Smith, Mormonism came to be in a time and place where religious idealism gave rise to new, decidedly American conceptions of a democratic voice. Unlettered men could speak on behalf of God, and God could in turn reveal his guidance, warnings, and inspiration to every man and woman attuned to his voice. Being able to hear and voice God gives Mormonism a particular vocal and theatrical quality. The voice and the stage are baked right into Mormon theology. Now, the woods and farmland outside of Joseph's home were within a day's journey from Rochester's urban playhouses. There, white performers like Thomas Rice codified the white appropriation of black vernacular speech and dance in minstrel characters like Rice's Jump Jim Crow. Thus, minstrelsy, which is one of the primary theatrical and musical components of American musical theater, became a cultural touchstone in America's urban centers around the same time and around the same place that America's hardiest and fastest growing religion was born. United by the Jacksonian principles of self-fashioning and increased attention to white prosperity, minstrels and Mormons both celebrated a kind of white supremacy couched within homegrown American exceptionalism. Mormons and the stylizations of American musical theater are therefore genetically related. Their iconic status as quintessential American institutions poetically underlines an actual ideological partnership. What most unites Mormons and musicals, however, is vocal theatricality, or how a person convinces another that they are channeling the voice of somebody else. I call this process the vicarious voice, and I believe Mormonism is theologically dependent on the practice to the degree that I think of Mormonism itself as having a theology of voice. The voice is what holds Mormonism together. For instance, Joseph Smith's indication in Mormon scripture that hearing the prophet's voice is literally the same as hearing God's voice, or how Peter McMurray has asked us to consider ways in which the Book of Mormon is more of a sound object than a text proper, itself calling itself, in fact, a voice whispering from the dust. In fact, Mormon lore is filled with intriguing models of vocal theatricality, and two in particular come to mind as significant for our story today. First, in the opening chapters of the Book of Mormon, a young prophet named Nephi is directed by God to kill his ecclesiastical leader, a man named Laban, dress up in his clothes, and speak in his voice. Readers learn that God asked Nephi to create this character in order to convince Laban's servants to hand over important genealogical and scriptural records that were, of course, necessary for Nephi's family as they prepare to flee Jerusalem for someday American continent. Now, if we pause for a moment, it may seem strange to you that God, the supposed arbiter of truth, would find it not only acceptable, but maybe even preferential that his servants model ways of being untruthful. And yet it may be that Mormonism itself survived in its current form because of a divinely sanctioned performance of untruthfulness. And this brings us to our second example of vocal theatricality. When in 1844, Brigham Young stood before the bereaved Mormons in Nauvoo, Illinois, after Joseph Smith was killed, he reportedly spoke with the voice of Joseph, supposedly confirming for many that he indeed had inherited the prophetic mantle. There are many reasons to suspect that this transfiguration never happened. But for argument's sake, we can suppose it did. There are only two explanations that seem plausible, at least to my mind. One, either Brigham Young indeed channeled Joseph through some kind of divine intervention, or two, Brigham Young was simply flexing his theatrical muscle. The former is supported by a host of scriptural precedents that suggest God is truly invested in show business. And the latter is supported by Young's own investment in show business. His friend Orson Hyde reported that Young was a great performer and could mimic anybody. And Young later became something of an impresario of the Salt Lake Theater, frequently performing as an actor himself. Now, those are two examples, and there are others. I'll mention a few, and you can maybe think of others that are in Mormon scriptures. Jesus appears as a gardener, or is mistaken as a gardener at his tomb. The disciples don't recognize him at Emmaus. Satan can transform himself into an angel of light. And even Jesus' atonement is, in a sense, this great drama acted out where it's, I pretend to be you, so therefore you pretend to be me. There are other examples, and I breeze through these two really quickly, but I hope the point is clear, that Mormon theology is uniquely tethered to displays of vocal theatrics. I cited a few extraordinary cases, but even laypersons participate in this vicarious voice every day in temple ceremonies, roadshows, or in the bearing of testimony that mimics the vocal styles and mannerisms of church leaders. In fact, Mormons are so attuned to the voice of the prophet that I suspect it is those who sound closest to this vocal standard who ascend the Mormon hierarchy the quickest. I also suspect that Mormons practice vocal theatricality in order to practice godliness. For if Jesus and other spiritual leaders rely on duplicity to go about their father's business, then righteous Mormons must in effect learn the ropes here on earth and find ways to practice vocal theatricality in whatever ways are available. Intermusical theater. In musicals, as in Mormonism, the voice is likewise put on prominent display. And of course, it's there for theatrical reasons. In contrast to many other popular music styles, the voice in musicals is utilitarian and always on purpose. Conventions in the genre allow the voice to say more than it tells. In effect, musicals rely on the voice to communicate words primarily and emotions secondarily. And not only that, but the act of singing itself lets audiences know who to trust and who is important. Singing becomes both the meta-concept and the vehicle of understanding that meta-concept, the currency through which musicals exchange meaning. Just think about how singing, or not singing, reinforces themes in West Side Story. The Jets are the dancing and singing gang. The Sharks either lack the ability or aren't afforded the opportunity, so audiences can hear plainly whose story this really is. Lyrics like, "My heart will be blessed with the sound of music, and I'll sing once more," when put in the mouth of the stoic Captain Von Trapp, suggests not only a singing character, but also one who is now shifted into the audience's circle of trust precisely because he is singing. And all the more convincing, he happens to be singing about singing. So by and large, singing or not singing makes it clear to the audience which characters are authentic or believable and which are not. This feature continues to make musicals an ideal venue for Mormons to practice vocal theatricality following the examples of Nephi or Brigham Young. But the voice in musicals also came to represent for Mormons during the 1940s an opportunity to matter again in the eyes of the nation, to be taken seriously and accepted as Americans on their own terms. Like characters in a musical, Mormons would need to cast themselves in a singing role if they wanted to be of much importance at all. So as the centennial celebration of the 1847 arrival of Mormon pioneers to Utah loomed near, the state of Utah, along with the Mormon Church, needed something to shift the conversation about Mormonism away from its more checkered past. The story of Mormonism, as state and religious leaders envisioned it, was inherently American, heroic, romantic, maybe even inspirational. With the nation's attention soon to be upon Utah, leaders knew they had an opportunity to restart the conversation on Mormonism on their own terms. The challenge was to find a medium that could capture the qualities of Mormon resilience and hold them up as quintessentially American, while also drawing attention away from the religion's more unpopular dogma. Musical theater offered them exactly that venue. And with Broadway's unapologetic connection with wealthy white urbanites in the East, it also proved providential in affirming the Mormon identity as decidedly white, comfortably middle class. With the recent popularity of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma in mind, the Utah Centennial Commission envisioned a new musical as the keystone to their celebrations and immediately set out to create a production on a professional scale never before mounted in Utah. The commission initially approached composer Kurt Weill, who some of you may know as composer for Street Scene or Knickerbocker Holiday. He declined. He said no, but he did suggest Arnold Sundgaard to write his lyrics, and Sundgaard you may know as the lyricist or librettist for Down in the Valley, Kurt Weill's last shows. So they got him to write the lyrics, and the commission instead tapped 25-year-old BYU student Crawford Gates to write the music in lieu of a big-name Broadway composer. So the musical Promised Valley premieres in 1947, and it follows a fictional Mormon family as they trek across the plains in search of religious freedom. The commission, as well as the Mormon Church, hoped the musical would sell the story of Mormons on the frontier as a quintessential American tale, similar to what Oklahoma had done. Oklahoma appeared in 1943. This is 1947. In fact, the commission made every effort to connect their show to the highly publicized integrated style of Oklahoma. And I'll just pause for a moment and explain what I mean by integrated musical. This is a phrase used by musical theater scholars. Prior to this point, revues, burlesques, vaudeville, minstrelsy, these were not shows that were bound together in any kind of sense. Often the song and dance were kind of periphery to whatever story is being told. With Oklahoma, we have the advent of an integrated musical. Well, every aspect of that musical is contributing to that singular story. So there's no fat on that. And that was a very highly publicized part of Oklahoma, and the commission's trying to tap into that. Integration means, of course, a lot of things in this moment for the Mormon Church. So the church looks to Broadway to hire the original musical director for Oklahoma and the choreographer for Annie Get Your Gun, which is on Broadway at the time. Young Hollywood starlet Jet McDonald was brought on to play the supporting role of Celia Cutler. And maybe the most overt attempt to cash in on Oklahoma's success was in hiring Alfred Drake, who played the original Curly McLean on Broadway, to play the lead. In this case, a Mormon man named Jeb Cutler, who joins the Mormon battalion to help get his wife across the plains to Utah. Virtually every piece of publicity for Promised Valley mentioned Drake's connection to the Broadway hit, putting it in large print in almost every poster, and here's just an example of this. So Promised Valley may be about Mormons traveling to Utah, but the real message is about the voice, and in effect, the show celebrates vocality as what united the tight-knit Mormon community, and consequently serves as an emblem of the religion's Americanness. Singing is emphatically conveyed in the show as a symbol of community and Mormon tenacity. 11 of the 17 musical numbers, let me say that, there's 17 musical numbers in this show, it's a lot, it's a big show. 11 of those are for chorus. This is unusual. So 11 choir numbers in Promised Valley, including one explicitly called the choir practice song. Given the framing conceit of the show that to be Mormon is to sing, the song demonstrates how the people become a community through singing together and almost serves as a primer for building community solidarity. The song hints that romantic relationships are made in choir practice, and new members are encouraged to please take it slowly and you'll get it perfect. Choir members pronounce all the rules of belonging, which include never be late, because the choristers eager to lead in our singing so that their hymns will be reaching to the skies. The song intentionally breaks beyond the fourth wall and gives Mormons a chance to essentially teach others how a disciplined voice makes a disciplined community. Again, an obvious appeal for acceptance among Americans who saw Mormon practices as largely undisciplined and morally weak. choral singing had been a staple of Mormon culture from its inception, and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir remains a spectacular example of this. But in the 1940s, collective singing represented a kind of discipline and patriotism as the country struggled to define itself against global powers. A disciplined voice to the ears of many signaled a disciplined and united country. Promise Valley's attention to the rules of choral singing therefore comes amid a period of great concern for how the collective body of the nation sounded. If becoming American depended to some degree on sounding American, then Promise Valley helpfully pointed to Mormons as exemplars of what Scott Carter calls sound citizenry. To further distance themselves from a perceived ill-refined sound of other racial or ethnic minorities, Mormons could demonstrate a concern with vocal discipline and establish a legacy of beautiful, meaning white, singing in their communities. In other scenes, Promise Valley adamantly promotes the Mormon work ethic. Chorus thus comes to represent Mormon industry and cooperation, a simulacrum of Mormon community. This vocal gimmick is so entrenched within the story that the main characters come to be identified as insider or outsider through their willingness and ability to sing in harmony with the rest of the community. The romance between Jed and Celia is portrayed as a successful attuning one to the other's voice. They sing lines like, "Love is their song," and "The music of our love so true will always be strong." The relationship is built from the same principle Isaiah wrote of when he considered the voices of God's special witnesses. With the voice together shall they sing, for they shall see eye to eye when the Lord shall bring again Zion. The four duets, again, this is unusual, four duets between the main between the leads. The four duets between Jed and Celia confirm that we ought to understand their relationship through song, since we hear them sing together far more often than we do alone. And this supports what we already knew about Jed and Celia, that by singing, they affirm their commitment to the community and show their willingness for hard work. They are both industrious and faithful people, and their reliance on song is what confirms those character traits. This is not the case with other characters. A man named Finley, for instance, is the show's comedic relief. He's more of a dandy, a former musician who frequently complains about having to work with his hands in the new territory. He can't seem to find a way to be cheerful and sing when faced with these hardships. His inability or unwillingness to sing underscores his laziness, and in effect serves as a comedic foil for the other members of the community who clearly understand and demonstrate that in Mormonism, to sing is to belong. So by way of conclusion, I want to fast forward several decades to the satirical Broadway show Book of Mormon, where we find the same principle of vocality at work. Elder Cunningham is a lousy Mormon missionary. He's never really prepared for his mission, and he kind of has never really read the Book of Mormon. He's occasionally prone to making things up when pressed for answers to questions he's obviously never considered himself. In the opening number, Hello, when all the missionaries are in training are militarily singing in harmony and in lockstep, Elder Cunningham's entrance immediately signals his outsider status. When he makes the gesture of pressing a doorbell, the sound effect audiences hear is an abrasive screech rather than the melodious ding-dong tones that you hear when the other missionaries do the same thing. So Elder Cunningham is literally out of tune with the others, and audiences have good reason to suspect that he might be trouble. And yet, in the end, we discover that Cunningham's, shall we say, sonic inconsistencies are his strength and not a liability. By mixing up Mormonism's theology, Cunningham lends voice to a new mythology, one that gives hope and encouragement to the Ugandan villagers as they live through challenging circumstances. The show ends like it begins, with Cunningham's new recruits modeling the kind of religious daring of Mormonism's founder, Joseph Smith, reminding audiences of the truthiness inherent in religious storytelling. As John Updike once said of stories such as these, the crucial question isn't, can you prove it, but does it give us a handle on the reality that otherwise would overwhelm us? So Book of Mormon's moralizing of what we might call tone-deaf Mormonism is an intriguing counterweight to Promise Valley's insistence that singing in harmony is what makes someone a good Mormon, and therefore a good American citizen. Both shows bookend Mormonism's aspirational journey toward white middle-class acceptance using musical theater on the one hand, and its ultimate ridicule by musicals for taking that aspirational whiteness too far. Yet what unites Promise Valley and Book of Mormon may be less their Mormon topics than the means by which Mormonism gets discussed, which arguably has everything to do with voice. In binding themselves so closely to musical theater, Mormons sang a provisional path toward American acceptance. Not fully understanding their chosen path toward belonging in America may have been Mormonism's biggest miscalculation. The mainstream values Mormons hoped to integrate into in the mid-20th century have since shifted over the years, as has the community surrounding American musical theater, both becoming more progressive and accepting than the Mormon church has been willing to accept. Just like Mormons queered themselves through presenting a vain and aspirational version of Mormonism in Promised Valley, Book of Mormon displays a queer version of Mormonism that throws back the curtains on once valued Mormon ideals of acceptance that now seem to many Americans out of character with the religion. Their lesson learned is a powerful one. In musicals, as in life, a vocal platform may give the sensation of real meaning, but true belonging means not just singing the notes of acceptance, but when you open your mouth, really actually meaning it. Thank you.
Interspersed in the pages of copies of the Book of Mormon and hanging on the walls of church buildings across the world, the images created by Arnold Freiberg have become iconic and almost inseparable from imaginings of the Book of Mormon in the Latter-day Saint mind. The rippling muscles of the figures illustrated depict a saga with racialized male characters valorized as the most important figures in the scriptural account. Drawing from his own anxiety of body, race, and masculine identity, Freiberg's Book of Mormon series also demonstrates a yearning to place LDS men in a broader context of American masculinity. Of his own body during his youth in Arizona in the early 20th century, Freiberg writes, quote, "Another influence in my life and in my art is the physical strength. I was a skinny kid. I was the skinniest kid I ever knew who lived. I knew one skinnier kid, but he died. I wasn't sickly or weak, especially, but I was just skinny. Being a skinny kid, I just felt awful. I was so embarrassed. I was scared to roll up my sleeves, you know. I had skinny arms. About the age of 15, I took up exercises. I put 7 inches on my chest in a year. Then my parents began to be proud of me and tell everyone else that they could do the same if they would just work at it. So I think I have never lost my adulation of masculine strength, and it comes out even now. Sometimes people say I put too many muscles on my Book of Mormon and Bible men. I am under no obligation to paint average bookkeeper types. There are plenty of husky men around the world, so I am perfectly justified. Plus the fact that I am painting the spirit of a man which is large, and it seems to require a large body to express it. Some men can have small bodies and still have tremendous spirits, but somehow when you go to paint it, it seems like you want to paint a large man. And then many of these men were large. George Washington was a large man, Lincoln was, Joseph Smith was, Nephi says that he was. Moses recorded that he was so large that even at the age of 3, people used to stop and notice. So we are perfectly justified in painting good, strong men. But this comes out in my nature, I think, largely due to my being such a thin kid during my boyhood. It may also be because of the study of exercise and bodybuilding, I came to have such an admiration, in fact, the worship of anatomy, bones and muscle," end quote. From an early age, Freiberg equates physical strength with a strong work ethic. His anecdote suggests that to obtain physical prowess, one need only to work hard. The hard work will culminate in a bigger body, the pride of one's parents, and a place next to historically strong figures. Freiberg's list of large figures with the inclusion of Book of Mormon prophets alongside American presidents further proves his need to assert LDS men as a part of the larger American narrative centered around male leadership. Just as men like Abraham Lincoln and George Washington physically embody the great American narrative, so do the Book of Mormon prophets. Freiberg's journey to Book of Mormon illustrator began at a young age. He toyed with ideas of American heroes in comic strips he illustrated as a boy. After completing correspondence courses in illustration, Freiberg took to the Chicago Art Institute for more training. After his service in the military during World War II, his return home and subsequent marriage to his wife Hedva, Freiberg began teaching commercial art at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Although he had moderate success doing illustrative work, his hope was that his close proximity to LDS Church headquarters would enable him to paint for the church. His work, especially his calendar illustrations of Canadian Mounties, impressed the president of the LDS Children Organization, then called the Primary Association, and she proposed to church leaders that Freiberg be commissioned to paint 12 paintings of the Book of Mormon for the church's children magazine, The Friend. The cost of the commission proved too much for the church, so the primary president, Adele Cannon Howells, a woman of, quote, social, political, and ecclesiastical prominence due to her family connections to church leadership, her own position in the church, and her family's wealth, paid for the paintings herself, though she never lived to see any of the paintings completed. Though Freiberg counseled with Howells before her death, he ultimately chose the final 12 scenes for the series based on their artistic possibilities. One concern the artist had in in illustrating certain Book of Mormon scenes was that he would get material details about the period wrong. He recognized that he must paint from conjecture and use artistic possibility. Besides projecting his own ideas about the archaeological possibilities of the period, Freiberg chose to project an imagined racialized masculinity into his paintings, suggesting that the spiritual strength of the men he portrayed was reflected in their physical stature, echoing ideas that began developing from his adolescent years. Quote, Freiberg, who had always admired great historical figures, envisioned the Nephites as heroic and larger than life and desired to convey that vitality in his art. He was not just inventing rules of engagement for a set of new creative paintings. He was, as it were, creating a wonderful new race of God's children. This new race included hyper-masculine standards of physical prowess. Many of the paintings in the series exhibit moments of male heroics. The figures stand erect and strong as they exhibit force through their movements. Even the figures Freiberg depicted as elderly demonstrate a taut musculature in their old age. They represent a hegemonic Eurocentric ideal of masculinity wrapped up in concerns of man's role in the modern age. The Nephites are clearly coded as white, while the Lamanites are coded as ethnic others. Almost all 12 of the paintings show outdoor scenes with men in protective and active roles. Freiberg almost exclusively paints Nephites, the people of the Book of Mormon often coded as racially white. Out of the 12 paintings in his series, only 3 included Lamanite figures, and only one of those depicts Lamanites in any sort of prominent placement in the composition. I'll show just several of these paintings as examples. This is Ammon Defends the Flocks of King Lamoni. The story of the missionary Ammon is among the most popularly told stories of the Book of Mormon. Ammon is the son of a Nephite prophet. During his youth, he does his best to antagonize church members and convince them to leave the church. He, his brothers, and another companion are confronted one day by an angel who preaches repentance, and the men are moved not just to change, but to action, deciding to become missionaries. Ammon specifically decides on a mission to the Lamanite people. He is captured and brought before King Lamoni, who questions Ammon's motives as a Nephite. Ammon insists that he just wants to live among the Lamanite people and serve them. The king allows him to do so by tending his flocks of sheep to keep them safe from other marauding Lamanites. Tending sheep, Ammon fends off the marauders by chopping off their arms, shocking other servants with his abilities, collecting the arms, and then presenting them to the king. The king is also shocked at Ammon's abilities and asks to meet with Ammon, suspecting that Ammon is a supernatural being. In a discussion of the nature of God and Jesus Christ, Ammon explains to the king that he is not supernatural, and in the end, the king converts. Freiberg's painting of the story of Ammon and the king's flocks establishes a binary between civilized Nephites and barbarous Lamanites as he paints the moment when Ammon defends the king's flocks. Foregrounded in the painting are sheep and rams running away from the robbers in the background. Ammon stands among them. Bare-chested and sword-drawn, facing the intruders, Ammon's body is positioned in a way that exhibits his musculature. He is tan but not dark-skinned. He is clean-shaven and appears to be wearing something resembling a Phrygian cap. He is contrasted by the figures running from the background of the painting toward him. The men depicted are wild. Their hair is long and unkempt. They wear long beards. They are also bare-chested, but their garb is not tanned leather like Ammon. Instead, they are othered as animal-like, with unfinished animal hides, skirts, and hairy chests, wielding clubs instead of swords. Their barbarism is juxtaposed to Ammon's civilized manners. In these ways, Freiberg establishes a racial dichotomy between refined Nephite and ferocious Lamanite. These are the 2,000 young warriors. Another popular Book of Mormon story highlights the experience of a group of 2,000 teenage boys who volunteer to fight with the Nephite army because their parents have taken a vow of nonviolence. Although the young men in this story are no longer called Lamanites, they are only one generation removed from the racially coded label of Lamanite. Because of their parents' conversion, this group of people is now called the Anti-Nephi Lehis. This group represents an interesting case study in the Book of Mormon for ethnic transition. Every depiction of this story illustrates the stripling warriors with dark skin. And yet, in popular Mormon imagination, and somewhat in the text itself, they are the heroes of these particular chapters. The parents of these warriors, who had been accepted by the Nephites, taken in, given a portion of Nephite land. When the Nephites come under attack by Lamanite armies, the first generation of anti-Nephi Lehis is distraught. They cannot fight because they made promises at their conversion to lay down weapons of violence. Their sons, however, did not. And so they take up arms under the direction of a Nephite general. Because of their youth, the Nephite general plans for the young warriors to merely be a distraction to the Lamanite troops and lead them away from the Nephite army. But when the Lamanites began to overpower the Nephites, the young warriors turn and fight. In the narrative, not one is killed or even seriously injured because the young men are so faithful. Though coded as racially other, they are ethnically a part of the Nephite people, so much so that the Nephite general Helaman repeatedly calls the young warriors his sons throughout the scriptural narrative. In Freiberg's painting, the viewer sees young warriors on a march. Though teenagers, their muscles are highly developed, and even their neck muscles seem to flex in rigorous march. They carry their spears erect, with shields strapped to their arms. They seem to march in unison as trained warriors, though it is indicated in the scriptural narrative that they have never been trained for battle. They join in a white hegemonic masculinity that represents power through physical strength. Several figures in the foreground with distinct facial features carry the same expression of determination. Their chests are bare, but banded around their waists are different fabrics that seem to carry no particular weight other than not Nephite, as differ with their tassels and texture from the garb of their white commander. Some wear wrist guards, while others wear armbands around their biceps. Each warrior wears the same yellow headband tied around the front of their foreheads and carries sheathed knives belted to their waists. Their feet are booted to the shins as they march through the flora of the landscape. Says Samuel the Lamanite on the wall. Samuel the Lamanite is an important figure in the Book of Mormon. Though the Book of Mormon sets up a racial disparity as a result of wickedness, that binary is flipped and Lamanites are the more righteous people at this point in the narrative. This happens just before the climax of the scriptural text, the appearance of a resurrected Jesus Christ in the Americas. 5 years before the birth of Jesus Christ in the Old World, Samuel the Lamanite appears to the Nephite people to call them to repentance and give them signs of the ensuing birth of the Savior of mankind. Freiberg's version of the story is highly cinematic and downplays the Lamanite-ness of Samuel. In this painting, Freiberg has created a version of an Aztec city. Samuel stands, arms outstretched, on a high stone wall in the background of the painting. Many feet beneath him is a crowd of people. The main action of the painting rests in the foreground with the Nephite archers. Arms extended, they lean back to take aim at Samuel. Their armor includes breastplates and helmets, almost Roman in design. No frontal faces are visible in the scene. Samuel is so far removed from the main action of the painting that it is impossible to make out his race. Little detail can be made out of his figure except his red cape flowing in the wind. Without understanding the scriptural narrative paired with the painting, it is difficult to determine who the good guys are. Freiberg excludes the important racial implications of this narrative. This is Mormon bids farewell to a once great nation. The final chapters of the Book of Mormon end in a great final battle between the Nephites and the Lamanites. At points in the scriptural narrative, there is peace, and as the text says, neither were there Lamanites nor any manner of ites, but they were in one. However, in the final chapters, the people are split into factions again. The authors of these last chapters, Nephite father and son named Mormon and Moroni, describe the absolute destruction of their people by the Lamanites. Though the battles are bloody and cruel, the blame for the demolition of the Nephite people is not solely placed upon the Lamanite people. It is the Nephites' own wickedness that brings the plight of war upon them. Freiberg's depiction of the last battle of the Nephites again highlights an imagined racial history. Against the backdrop of a blood-red sky, prophet historian Mormon gazes out over a battlefield. Littered on the ground around him are the corpses of his dead comrades. Scavenger birds circle the air in the background. Behind Mormon kneels his son Moroni. With bulging muscles and pseudo-Roman Nordic armor, Moroni looks down at his father. All figures, both living and dead, are white. Freiberg is representing the end of the Nephite nation, the end of whiteness. Absent from the painting are Lamanites, though the scriptural text is very inclusive of their presence. Freiberg described the scenes in terms of a Wagnerian epic, quote, "Now we are talking about the last picture. This is after the last battle. This is downright Wagnerian, isn't it? Of course, I love Wagner. I love the great hero tales of Siegfried. The story of Moroni is the story of Siegfried. Every hero story is the story of Siegfried. This represents the solemn scene with heaps of body lying about. So I had to picture the carnage and death, but I tried to do it tastefully. Not a lot of blood and wounded bodies. I tried to capture the Gottdämmerung feeling, such as Wagner could have captured in music. This is the end of a nation and an entire race. Mormon was wounded in the fight, and so they have laid him down there on the hilltop. Things like this one last leaf on the tree had their own little symbolism. You see the buzzard circling because there is death all around. Blood on the sun. This is really Wagnerian tragedy. Also, you notice this flag behind Moroni on the pole is the same flag raised long ago by Captain Moroni when he rallied the Nephites to fight for freedom. I think they would have persevered. That flag of Captain Moroni is the old title of liberty. And I think at the end they would have said, we weren't worthy to live under Moroni's flag. Let us at least die like men under the flag. If I had been making a motion picture, I would have them get out the old flag of Captain Moroni's and say, at least let us die, at least let us fight and die under it if we are men at all, end quote. Here, Freiberg's explanation of the painting is rife with hegemonic ideals of masculinity. In Freiberg's mind, the epic last battle of the Book of Mormon is best represented by referencing a great German composer. This is seen in the costuming of each figure. Here, Freiberg has visualized the scene as something out of a movie. Freiberg's depiction of the carnage of war are acts of manhood. Freiberg frames the scene as the end of a nation and an entire race, although depicting no Lamanites. When contextualized against subjects of his other works, it is again apparent that Freiberg saw his own and therefore LDS masculinity in a broader North American narrative. Freiberg's popularity began first with his paintings of the Royal Mounted Police as illustrations for the Northwestern Paper Company. His illustrations of this police force parallel what he would later paint in his illustrations of the Book of Mormon. Commissioned as calendar pieces, the images were highly illustrative and visually dynamic, meant to draw in the viewer with a strong narrative, the bright recognizable color of the Mountie uniform and majestic scenery. Like the later Book of Mormon series, the Mountie illustrations are often presented in racial dichotomies with a white hero. The idea of a lonely hero is also something Freiberg saw mirrored in his personal life. In the midst of his job for the LDS Church, Freiberg puts his commission on hold to work for Cecil B. DeMille creating concept art for the Ten Commandments. Though he was on contract to finish completing his work on the Book of Mormon paintings, Freiberg asked permission from LDS Church President David O. McKay to put his work on hold in Hollywood. According to Freiberg, McKay readily grants his permission, and this is how Freiberg describes his feelings at the time. It was Christmas season, and I remember how isolated I felt. At that time, I had long hair and a beard. I had grown them to study the Bible characters. I was not trying to be a character. I remember walking down that street and utterly felt apart from the human race. How lonely. I just felt it doesn't matter. I was isolated. It was something like when your outfit moves into combat and war. Once you get on that ship, you are isolated from the rest of the world. But there, at least, you had company. It's your guys in there with you. But there is isolation. This feeling came to me, and I was all alone as I walked down Main Street. I never forgot, you might say, my trepidation. I don't know what it was. I don't know that it was fear, but I knew how bad it would be doing the Ten Commandments. When it came, it was worse than anything I had expected. With his words, Freiberg creates a scene of dramatic isolation. Yet in this isolation, he compares and integrates himself with war heroes. Much like the physical transformation he has put himself through to study for his paintings, here Freiberg metaphorically equates himself to the men he paints. He has isolated himself and them in heroic burdens, and in doing so, integrates them all into one grand religious American narrative.
In some ways, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints First Museum was in Joseph and Emma Smith's home as they displayed Egyptian mummies bought along with the papyri in 1835. This amateur exhibition was not merely the first museum associated with the LDS Church. Rather, it was also the beginning of the Church's efforts to collect and display objects from other cultures. Only a few years later, a call went out in an 1843 Times and Seasons for people to help build a collection for a museum in Nauvoo. Near the end of the piece, the anonymous author remarks, quote, "It is for the saints to snatch from the ruins of ancient greatness everything that is interesting, great, valuable, and good, whether in religion, morality, arts, and sciences, and bring them to the city of the saints, that intelligence may dwell in our midst," end quote. In short, with this desire to collect ethnographic objects from across the globe, the Latter-day Saints were no different from other collectors during the 19th century. While the Nauvoo Museum never reached fruition, a museum was established in Utah in 1869. First named the Salt Lake City Museum and Menagerie, and later renamed the Deseret Museum, the institution served as a natural history and ethnology museum. The ethnology collection included, according to its director, James E. Talmage, quote, "human remains of men, women, and children, with a wide variety of artifacts such as tools, weapons, ornaments, sandals, and other articles of dress, end quote. Other anthropological exhibits focus on Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, and people from Eastern Asia. In 1919, the Deseret Museum became the LDS Church Museum, and the focus shifted. The church transferred the natural history and ethnology collections to other institutions and focused instead on history. More shifts in institutional identity occurred, with the Museum of Church History and Art opening in 1984. Despite deaccessioning natural history and ethnology artifacts, the church retained a focus on global cultures at both later iterations of its museums. According to the gallery guide for the exhibit Church Museums Past and Present, the LDS Church Museum had a, quote, growing interest in world cultures, end quote, and the Museum of Church History and Art possessed a, quote, interest in a worldwide church and its history from the 1820s to the present, end quote. There was an interesting shift from teaching visitors about other cultures to integrating diverse peoples within LDS church history. This pivot begs the questions. What does the changing focus reveal about the church's perceived relationship with diverse groups and its ideas of a religious community? How did its exhibitions play a role in representing the globalizing faith? What do both the art and exhibitions suggest about the intersection between church and religion? In a society filled with accusations of fake news and public mistrust, people maintain a considerable degree of confidence in museums. According to the American Alliance of Museums, museums are considered the most trustworthy source of information in America. Part of this trust presumably comes from a perception of objectivity and neutrality, an assumption that has caused problems in the past. For example, the proposed and later scrapped Smithsonian exhibition on the Enola Gay in the 1990s sparked controversy over historical interpretation, with some critics operating under the assumption that objects should speak for themselves. However, museums are inherently ideological. They shape both public knowledge and behavior. Because of this power, many museums, especially government-funded, use their display of art and artifacts to create a national identity. As Carol Duncan and Alan Wallach assert in their foundational work, the Universal Survey Museum, quote, the museum stands as a symbol of the state, and those who pass through its doors enact a ritual that equates state authority with the idea of civilization, end quote. More specifically related to multicultural exhibitions, Ivan Karp insists that, quote, what is at stake in struggles for control over objects and the modes of exhibiting them, finally, is the articulation of identity. Exhibitions represent identity, either directly through assertion or indirectly by implication. When cultural others are implicated, exhibitions tell us who we are and, perhaps most significant, who we are not, end quote. While these arguments about the ideological power of museums relate to political identity, we could similarly apply the same argument to the Museum of Church History and Art's exhibitions of non-Western art. Church curators decided what to display and how to display it, and the overarching purpose of the exhibitions related to the identity of the larger religious community. Indeed, we could simply replace state with church. So how did the museum use art to shape identity and represent the faith in a new way? What identity did they try to create through the exhibitions? In short, the goal was to both demonstrate and unify the church's global membership. The curators asserted that the LDS Church was not merely a Utah or American religion, but rather a diverse institution successfully integrated across the globe. As the Relief Society Mollis exhibition curator state, quote, shows such as this not only expand the horizons of members, but may also serve to make various groups feel more integrated into the whole as they hear about the church museum celebrating their culture and traditions, end quote. In many ways, the exhibitions were not actually about a culture's art itself, but rather assertions of the church's widespread presence in its missionary efforts. The Museum of Church History and Art was a way to create a Mormon identity that included international and minority members. In displaying the non-Western art, the museum attempted to sort out what it meant to be a Latter-day Saint. In theory, integration was an admirable goal. We should want all people to feel welcome in the religion. However, problems arose as the church's museum repeatedly weighed cultural traditions against LDS beliefs. This has precedence in church history. For example, Brandon Morgan argues that, quote, missionary efforts and the placement program both stressed faith rather than culture, end quote. In some ways, culture was seen as an ancillary aspect to one's identity. For example, the curators assert in the Relief Society Mollusk Gallery Guide, that, quote, the typical museum visitor from the United States will almost certainly first notice the obvious differences in dress, use of color, nose rings, huts, etc. But behind all these externals is a system of belief which has brought many kuna into the church, end quote. While the curators were trying to help visitors find commonalities and encourage unity, the characterization of cultural traditions as externals deemed culture insignificant or unimportant. Because of this view, the museum continually pushed for cultures to adapt to the church, not the other way around. There's a problematic element whereby culture could be retained only so far as it was approved or already fit with the gospel. The Relief Society Mollusk Guide poses questions about what can be kept or dismissed from cultures. It hoped visitors would consider these questions. What does it mean to be a Latter-day Saint? What is essential to do or believe? What must be abandoned from a familiar culture? What can be retained? Which cultural trappings ultimately make no difference to the progress of the gospel? How can people from various cultures mutually enrich each other? While the guide acknowledges that, quote, these same questions apply to those of us living in the core region, end quote, there is a qualifying statement that it may be easier to start thinking about these issues in the context of an unfamiliar culture as we sort out what is and is not ultimately compatible with the gospel, end quote. One's culture is only accepted on a conditional basis. Narrow definitions of LDS art became a way to prioritize religious beliefs over cultural traditions. In the book Images of Faith, the Church Museum curator Richard G. Oman argues that, quote, with members working in so many places, in so many styles, could we simply say that any art done by church members is Latter-day Saint art? The problem with this definition is that its broadness drains it of meaning. A useful criterion for creating a currently functional definition of Latter-day Saint art would be to emphasize thematic content rather than style, technique, or geography, end quote. The point is clear. Members around the world can be considered LDS artists only if their artwork represents LDS themes. There's diversity in medium and style, but all centers around the same topic. It is not about finding unity in diversity, but rather diversely representing unity. More importantly, this focus on LDS themes meant that acculturation was frequently on display in these exhibitions of non-Western art. For museum visitors, seeing LDS themes integrated using traditional cultural aesthetics demonstrated the successful adoption of the religion. However, it is not just that the artwork represented gospel topics. Rather, there was often an adoption of mainstream Mormon phraseology and imagery, as well as a continued emphasis on the American nature of the religion. For example, Filipino artist Lourdes D. Sampson created an embroidery piece with Families Are Forever displayed prominently while a family points at the Salt Lake City Temple. Similarly, Armenian artists Ruben Ozonian, Mary Ozonian, and Josephine Ozonian Kazakian created a tapestry with LDS prophets and temples along the border and a middle panel depicting pioneers with the caption, Utah, the Star of the West. The acculturation process is especially evident in art pieces that mimic popular Mormon artwork. For example, Chilean artist Jacinta Arzumeta embroidered a piece representing the first vision that takes as its model Greg Olson's painting of the same subject. Similarly, Indonesian artist Hadi Pranado bases batik, The Second Coming of Christ, on a Harry Anderson painting. The popular LDS artwork we are all familiar with works as a colonial tool. Alicia Gaspar de Alba, speaking about Chicano-Chicana artwork, argues that, quote, the acculturation process began back in their homelands through the colonizing tactics of mass media and popular culture. Thus, U.S. films, magazines, music, television, advertising, and popular iconography constituted the technological goop upon which their conceptions of America were fed. In a similar way, the LDS acculturation process began through the images transported abroad. Conceptions of Mormonism were based on this iconography. The gallery guide for the Indonesian batik exhibition explicitly addresses this borrowing. However, the curators do not seem to recognize this process as acculturation. Rather, they explore the issue of whether copying popular art degrades the batiks. The curators propose in the guide, let us consider here how we feel about and assess the worth of LDS folk art when it borrows or copies standard, mass-produced LDS illustration and art. We are disposed, because of an inherited aesthetic bias, towards the new, the unique, the individual, to be disappointed when folk arts, including the batiks, are not totally novel, that they are somehow tainted because they have borrowed from art tradition, end quote. To address this concern, the guide quotes Richard Oman, who contends that the artists borrow those images because they are trying to feel a part of the community, and that copying depictions is a way to, quote, artistically manifest their new commitment to a new religious culture, end quote. It is notable that the museum curators discourage against the idea that this artwork is not high quality. The quality debate is a major issue in the art world when museums display works other than fine art. To include folk art disrupts conceptions of what is even considered art, and Oman's comments push against classist and ethnocentric biases. However, we need to examine seriously how the artwork both reflects and reshapes an official version of American LDS culture. Oman's remark that, quote, such images may represent the main body of the church for folk artists, quote, should not be a way to justify borrowing. Rather, it is imperative to examine the idea that predominantly white, male, American artists represent the main body of the church. Inherent in the statement is an othering, positioning of us versus them. Oman's statements attempt to include non-Western art into the canon of LDS art, but it does not attempt to dismantle or question the canon itself. More importantly, much of the art is not merely borrowing. It is not a paint-by-numbers type of copying. Rather, the artists use the popular church imagery in a new way that localizes stories. For example, in his batik, The First Vision, Indonesian artist Joni Susanto echoes Ted Hanager's depiction of the event, but changes the landscape from that of a Palmyra, New York forest. By remaking with a difference, the artists assert their place in the church. While the Museum of Church History and Art attempted to expand conceptions of church membership, it did not represent the actual relationship between the church and different cultures. The foundational tenet of Edward Said's concept of Orientalism is the idea that representations of other cultures say more about the creators than the depicted. The same principle applies to the church's museum exhibitions. The exhibitions represented an idealized version of that relationship. The museum almost uniformly characterizes these relationships in positive terms. The framing not only elides a colonial mindset, but at times praises this dynamic. This colonial mindset is particularly evident in the church's exhibitions of Native American artwork. In fact, one of the first exhibitions when the Museum of Church History and Art opened was the exhibition Latter-day Saint Native American Art. A second version of the exhibition opened in 1988. From the very beginning, the gallery guide for this exhibition presents a problematic view of the relationship between the church and Native Americans that features colonial overtones, elides traumatic encounters, and pushes an unsubstantiated historical narrative. As the guide claims, from its beginnings in 1830, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has maintained a fervent interest in the Indians of Americas. Latter-day Saint pioneers generally lived in harmony among tribes of the American West. This commitment reflects a desire to preach the gospel to the modern remnants of the ancient people described in the Book of Mormon. A later exhibition that opened in 1994, Sacred Connections, Art, and the Native American Latter-day Saints in the Southwest, dedicated an entire exhibition gallery to trading posts. As the guide explains, quote, visitors learned that Latter-day Saint traders shared the gospel with the Navajo, helped refine Navajo weaving, befriended and defended the Navajo, and helped expose the outside world to Navajo art and beauty, end quote. The contention that LDS traders helped refine Navajo weaving is especially important. Repeatedly, the guide asserts that traders not only influenced Navajo rug making, but improved it. One trader, George Bloomfield, noted that, quote, there was no such thing as a Two Gray Hills rug when I bought the Todlana Trading Post. The first rugs I bought were just common ones, woven in natural wool colors of gray, white, black, and brown, end quote. In fact, at one point the guide states that, quote, the Bloomfield's family relationship with the Navajo explains why they wanted to restore Hosho to the weaving, end quote. The museum never questions or critiques the idea that outsiders could restore Hosho, a complex concept related broadly to peace and harmony, to the Navajo people, or that they would even have the right to do so. It upholds the assumption that white men know what is best for others. The Museum of Church History and Art did not just reflect the church's colonialist mindset, it also perpetuated it. As Elise Boxer argues, Quote, the power to define the other was an important part of Mormon colonization, end quote. This happened in both artwork itself and the exhibitions as a whole. Several times the museum displayed depictions of Native Americans not done by Native artists. In the 1992 exhibition, Spiritual Foundations of Latter-day Saint Art, the curators displayed a sculpture by Cyrus E. Dallin titled Appeal to the Great Spirit, which depicts a Sioux chief following a defeat. Later, in 1996, the museum opened the exhibition Hopi, Navajo, Apache Life, artwork by Mahanra Young, a whole show whereby a white man represented other people and was seen capable of doing so. The very process of creating the exhibitions also perpetuates this colonial mindset. Members of each respective culture are not co-creators of the exhibitions. Rather, museum curators created the exhibitions, choosing which pieces to display and determining how to frame the art. In short, the museum curators possessed all the power to interpret other cultures, traditions, and beliefs. Frequently, this took the form of the museum fitting different culture, different traditions and beliefs into an LDS framework. Mormon terms literally redefine them. The Museum of Church History and Art might have exhibited art from members across the world, but inclusion alone does not create unity nor guarantee diversity, nor guarantee equality. Members and the institutional church are structures of power. The relationship between the institutional church and its minority and international members was fundamentally unbalanced in those exhibitions, as the museum curators redefined, reframed, and even distorted culture traditions, practices, and beliefs. At the Museum of Church History and Art, diversity was a category trotted out to show the international nature of the LDS Church. Even in exhibitions that mixed Western or non-Western art, certain artworks appear repeatedly. For example, in several other exhibitions, the church displays the Kuna Molas and the Indonesian batiks. There certainly might have been limitations in the collection, and it's better to include the artwork than exclude it. But as Alicia de Gaspar de Alba argues, quote, the bottom line of multiculturalism is difference, and difference has never had power in this country. Difference gets melted down, exoticized, stereotyped, invisibilized, end quote. The church tried to send the message that it has faithful members all over the world, but use the same artwork again and again to signal that message. As a whole, the repetition of the same artwork tokenized diversity. This tokenization and lip service given to diversity via art is not limited to the former Museum of Church History and Art. Rather, it continues and we see it outside of the museum. Official church materials and meeting houses continue to exclude art from members across the globe. The Gospel Art Library does not include non-Western artworks, and in the new Come Follow Me manual, the only non-American or non-European artist included is Argentinian artist Jorge Coco. If the church hopes its members across the world feel included, there needs to be more than a few representative works. Rather, there should be a change in content and process. We should ask what we can learn from these past exhibitions in order to develop better ways to foster inclusion and unity through art. Is it through a collaborative acquisitions and curatorial process? Is it by dismantling the current LDS art canon? This is an issue that the church needs to seriously consider moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you to all of the panelists. I was gratified to be invited to do this, to get a sneak peek at the presentations, and then to be able to see visuals is always helpful. So what I have are musings and really kind of in the form of questions, and the individual panelists can decide which ones they want to take up and which ones they want to just let go. So I'll start first with Jake. I'm really excited about your book and looking forward to its publication, and was glad to see that you were promoting that and that we can have access to that, and a really terrific cover, too. And I imagine that the book amplifies many of the points that I would am curious about, too. So I'm wondering if you could say something more about the gendered dimensions of vocality in Mormon theology and in Mormon history, and especially because the spoken tradition and the oral tradition is often associated with women. And I think it's an interesting kind of linkage of spoken word and how that functions. So Maybe some more thoughts on that would be helpful. Also, let's see. I'm wondering kind of what you make of the fact that for many, the group formerly known as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the TV broadcast, The Spoken Word, is the way that many meet the Mormons for the first time, right? And sort of the, you know, what the history is of the Spoken Word, you know, calling it the Spoken Word, what that might mean. And then, of course, I started thinking about all of these kind of privileging that we do. We don't talk about... when Joseph Smith's first encounter, right, with deity, it's the first vision, not the first hearing. And I just think that that's kind of an interesting way of framing, you know, these things that we privilege the visual over some of these other forms of communication. I wondered too, because I deal more with the visual arts. This emphasis on vocality, you know, how much of it is, I guess, theological? How much of it is historical? How much of it we've really embraced the theatrical arts in LDS culture? Is that because of the weight of Brigham Young and what he, you know, threw behind the dramatic arts? I didn't realize how central, I guess, musicals are to Mormon culture until I started talking to people about musicals outside of our culture. And they didn't do road trips where they sang the entire score of West Side Story. I had no idea, right, that was not the norm. So I'm really, you know, kind of fascinated about like how we have adopted that form and really through road shows and speech contests and other kinds of things, which sadly we don't do or at least as much anymore. How that plays out. So those are just a few of my kind of thoughts. I'm going to give all of my yes, okay, rather than going back and forth. Okay, Rebecca, I'm really gratified to see that Arnold Freiberg's works receiving greater contextualization and analysis, and that you bring up so many important issues, and particularly, you know, focusing on how race figures into that. So what do you make of the fact that the commission was given by a woman for children? Why didn't she ask Minerva Tykert to do this, right? And how would that have changed our experience of reading and listening to and understanding the Book of Mormon, right? Minerva Tykert had just finished the murals, right, at the Manti Temple. She was doing a lot of Book of Mormon paintings. So I don't know if we have an answer to that, but it would have been a kinder and gentler sort of Book of Mormon illustration. And I would argue Mormon iconography, right? So I'm gonna have you wait. Okay, yeah, I figured, right? And I wondered, I mean, the LDS Church has always been very ambivalent about the visual arts, and I think it's in large part because of its connection to Catholicism and to you know, the worship of icons and so on. So I wondered if this was an attempt. It was initiated by a primary president, but then it was endorsed by the first presidency, which we see those sorts of gestures happening sort of a lot, right? A kind of thawing of this resistance to the visual arts and saying, look, the church needs to have an iconography, needs to have symbolism, needs to have recognizable objects and so on. I was fascinated to know that these images are relevant to Freiberg's own body anxieties. What about those of just Mormon men and those of his era? How is it related to broader cultural obsessions? One of the most famous objects of the 1950s, it's a British pop collage, and it features a cutout from a magazine that's advertising bodybuilders, right? and is creating this new utopia, and this hyper-masculinity was part of that. So I just kind of wondered about that, and then if this is part of the mainstreaming of Mormonism via the visual arts. Clearly, it's contributed to definitions of Mormon masculinity and the reification of the importance of physical strength, of aging men, of these other kind of symbols of power. They were done in the 1960s, is that right? Okay, early 50s, late 50s? Okay. Well, I wondered if there was some sort of connection to the hippie generation and some of the anxieties around long hair, being unshaven, creating grooming standards and so on, but maybe that was a little bit too early. And then the definitions of Mormon masculinity, of course, this affects the way women experience not just the reading of the Book of Mormon, but how might these images have contributed to our conception of the body, our body perfectionism, body shame, issues of modesty. I mean, I just think about how, at least for my generation, how ubiquitous those images were. I mean, it was every lesson had that, that poster put up, right? And programs for sacrament meeting and so on. So I think the implications for Freiburg's imagery are really kind of important for us to think about and unpack a little bit. And then lastly, Hillary, thank you. You're asking some really important questions about global Mormonism and representation and acculturation and difference and big questions. I'm wondering what you think about, I guess, the development, right? Because you were doing a broad, from the beginning, which was fascinating, by the way, of thinking about the original museum being in the Smith home and how truly global it was at the time, right? Of that, through the 1990s, if you see significant shifts, and if you can tie some of those shifts to things that are happening historically. So, like in the 1980s, there was a very controversial show in New York where they were putting so-called tribal art, right, or non-Western art, up against Picasso, Matisse, and others, and it just ignited this big discussion in the art world about appropriation and. They talked about affinities and without understanding some of the complexities there. So, I'm wondering if you have a sense of how attuned the church curators might have been to that and so on. And then how / have things changed in the church museum since the 1990s? Has there been a greater awareness and attempt to ameliorate some of these issues? Is there anybody here from the church museum? Oh, good. Good. I too work for the church and have done some work at the BYU Museum of Art, and I understand there are so many competing demands, right, for curation and competitions and so on. So, I mean, I too wondered what kind of record or repository we have about the history, the historiography, I guess is what I'm saying, of the church museum, right? Are there notes where curators are debating, we can't include this because we should say this? It would be fascinating to just know if we had good records of those things, that they could be accessed. So maybe you can let us know that line that we have back there of museum folk. You're right to query the effects of downplaying cultural differences in visual material culture in an attempt to emphasize our spiritual commonalities, right? And that we frame and experience and express our spirituality through cultural frameworks, right? So so I think that that's a really important thing. So the question for me, I have two big, I guess, big questions. One is, you know, about the place of the Church History Museum and its impact for affecting change, right? Because in terms of who goes and visits the church museum, right? Who and what that looks like in terms of nationalities and race and gender and class and so on. And, you know, is that monitored? Is there data on the museum webpage webpage visits where you can see certain people are more interested in this object than that object? And I just, you know, a lot of it is, I think, difficult to track and to quantify, I guess, impact. To my mind, images and objects that are put on the church's webpage, that are featured in conference, that are published in Ensign, the New Era, and the Friend, and then especially now with the catalog, what's it called, of appropriate art for meeting houses, that that does a lot to kind of determine our visual culture. And then the big question is, you know, things like the international art competition and so on, how much do they matter? How much do they affect change? What can be done, right? And I mean, I think we all know a lot of it is that we have to relinquish our own ideas, our own privilege, our own positions, and listen, learn, and make space for people, for the diversity within the Mormon Church and Mormon culture, and that can sometimes be difficult. And then the last thing is the really big thing. I mean, you started poking the bear a little bit about, like, how do we define LDS art or Mormon art? And I know I would rather answer the question, what is art, than answer the question, what is Mormon art? It is something, I mean, that I have to discuss, but, you know, is it, what makes art LDS? Is it gospel subjects? Is it historical topics? Is it membership in the church? Is it enough to be baptized, or do you have to have gone kind of further, unless, you know, and then you qualify as being TBM, right? You know, activity levels, you know, what if the art's critical of the church? You know, is it still included in that? And, you know, I'm thinking a lot about this because I am, you know, working on contributing to the discussion about what this Mormon art looks like. And really, it's been 25 years since Richard Ullman's book, right, about images of faith. And So I think that it should look different. So those are some of my questions, queries, and so on. Should everybody else come up here? Okay.
I can go since the mic is right here. I was interested in Arnold Freiberg because I was writing my thesis on Minerva Tykert, and they were painting almost the exact same subjects at the exact same time. And the only reference that, I don't know if Freiberg, it was, I haven't delved that deeply into primary source research on him outside of his paintings and then things he's said about himself. But Minerva Tykert wrote in a letter to, so she was doing these Book of Mormon paintings with the idea to have them be used as a proselytizing tool for missionaries. So she was in communication, according to her, with David O. McKay, and meeting with him in his office is what she told her daughter while her daughter was a missionary in Mexico. And then she just writes to her daughter, they've decided to go with this Freiberg guy. And that's all she says. So I don't know what happened, but then, you know, Minerva falls out of favor for a long time. So I think that's what. And then I was doing my master's in Wyoming, and my home teacher at the time was Minerva Tykert's great grandson. And I remember being in a Sunday school class with him, and he was talking about the Book of Mormon paintings by Freiberg and being like, yeah, it's like so buff. And I like turned around and I was like, you know, guys don't look like that, don't you? And he was like, yeah, of course they do. Like, I'm on a ranch. I know these things. And I was like, did you know your great-grandmother was using figures from her ward? Like, she was using people from her ward as figure models. And I don't, like, Freiberg, the only thing I found is that he was, like, using himself. So, and this imagined, like, whatever, I don't know. So it really affected. It would make a lot of guys that I knew who were my friends in Wyoming, like, upset when I would be like, this is made up, this isn't what men look like. But it did open, like, being in that space in Wyoming, talking about masculinity so often was super eye-opening to me, and that's why, like, I kind of switched my thesis was on Minerva Tyker, but then I really wanted to add this chapter in where I compared the two because the parallels are really interesting in understanding, even today, what masculinity is in the church. So, yeah.
I can answer really quickly. Thanks, Heather, for those great comments. And this is the beginning of a project, so it's like, I don't have an answer to a lot of them. I will say, I just recently went to the Church History Museum and the international competition, and they're even on the wall, it's talked about wanting to expand the canon. So I think, I mean, explicitly right there, there's a desire. And I think, so this is obviously like in the 80s, and there's a whole different issue. But in terms of like the place of the Church History Museum, I think sometimes there can be a disconnect between what the museum is doing and maybe what Correlation is doing, because that's why I'm looking, come follow me, and I'm like, we have had the international art competition for, like, this is, we're in the 11th one, I think. No. What number? Okay. And, no. And yet, Come Follow Me is new, and yet, where is this art? So it's kind of this disconnect, and I think the museum is maybe doing more than what the church is doing in terms of its outreach for art. And I don't know if it needs to be more of a conversation or where that disconnect is, but I think there's still a struggle with how church leaders are thinking about culture. I mean, we have had recent talks, I think, by Oaks and Elder Cook about, like, how important is culture and, like, maybe culture is important. Or, like, there's kind of that still that disconnect between how important is culture to identity, and I think that's maybe affecting things. But it's something I definitely need to look more into.
Just really quick, to one of your points, Heather, I do talk about this in the book. The first vision is absolutely mislabeled. It really is. The central drama is about orality. Joseph can't speak. The commandment from God is to hear, right? And this kind of vocal punishment that happens to Joseph, it happens in other scriptures, right? We are accounted for people who go mute and they can't speak and those kinds of things. But I think it relates to Mormonism especially because Mormon conceptions of the divine beings have bodies and voices and lungs and mouths and teeth, just like we do. And that's different from amorphous beings who kind of just exist. And so I think that's absolutely the reason why Mormonism, to me, is different from other religions and has its theology has kind of been skirted around voice. But in my way of thinking, I'm a musicologist, so I have to think of it this way, but sound is actually the thing Mormonism is. It's about voice.